and welcome to Tigers by the Fire, a podcast out of Holy Cross High School about World War II discussions and stories. This is episode 2 of season 4 of Tigers by the Fire. Today with me are Wyatt Audler.
Hi, nice to be here.
Alec Lanning.
Hello, I'm Alec.
And Matthew Gorbity.
Hello, I was in the last episode.
Matthew was in our last episode, and actually he's going to piggyback off that first episode and talk about the topic that he did a report on for George Washington University and actually a briefing at the site, and that is Pegasus Bridge in Normandy, France. The Battle of Pegasus Bridge is the first battle of D-Day. It takes place the night before the beach landings and is comprised of the British commando units, and it is considered to be the first part of France liberated by the Allies on D-Day. So with that being said, I'm going to turn it over to Matthew because I know he's got a lot to say. He's been there. He's eaten at the restaurant. He's been all over. So Matthew, take it away.
So just to get out the way, Pegasus Bridge was a covert operation that only lasted about 6 hours, but it has more implications than just being a 6 hour battle on a bridge or a six hour battle on a bridge. It had more to do with the invasion of Normandy than it did just liberating France first. It took place on the night of June 5th and then went into the morning of June 6th, which is D-Day. So to start off, how was it planned out? It was primarily based off of the success with Operation Fortitude, which is an operation that the Allies did to prop up a base that was full of fake soldiers that were POWs, and they sent out fake messages and had fake tanks and fake soldier movements, and the whole thing about it was just fake, and it was used to throw off the Nazis and to kind of...
Yeah. I messed up. No, you're good. You're good. Okay. No, you actually hit the nail on the head. Operation Fortitude, there's two of them. There's Fortitude North, Fortitude South. And the idea is to make the Nazis think that the Allies are either invading Norway, which I think was the far flung one, though Churchill did advocate for that at one point, or that they're invading Calais, France, that natural crossing of the Pas de Calais. And so to your point, like, this is piggybacking off of that. They're utilizing the fact that the Nazis do not have units in the Normandy region or enough to offset this invasion. So no, that was a good explanation. You were right on, Matthew. So continue.
So even though Operation Fortitude was successful and it was largely considered to be successful by the Allies because the Nazis had no clue what was going on, they still wanted more of an edge. And so this began the planning for Operation Tonga and Dead Stick. Tonga being the Allied gliding into Pegasus Bridge, and Dead Stick being the specific use of gliders to complete this operation. And so these operations were intended to secure the left flank of the Normandy landing against any possible German counterattacks on Sword Beach, which was the largely British beach. So they needed protection for the invasion of Normandy, and after a bunch of deliberation, they decided that Pegasus Bridge and the Orne River Bridge, which are right on the other, like, it's in the middle of a river and it kind of diverges into two smaller ones. And so there's bridges on both sides.
Yeah, we're right near the Caen Canal. And so do you remember why they needed to take these bridges? What are they trying to prevent by taking the bridges?
The German panzer tanks getting to the beaches?
To the beaches, right? Because if the German panzers are on the beach, they can really devastate the landing forces in the morning. So, and the Caen Canal, it's pretty big. I mean, we saw it when we were there. It's pretty wide, so it's not something you could traverse without these bridges. And we had bombed a series of them, and we're going to try, or the British are going to try and take these two key bridge holdings to not only stop the Germans from reinforcing, but also give the British a chance to cross that canal and make it to Caen, which we know takes forever, but still, that's what it is. Now, I know you're going to talk about Major John Howard, who I think he's a really cool character. This is someone, if you don't know much about him, we could go all day about him. He's like the British version to Captain America. Like, he just has this really crazy life, and I'm gonna let Matthew kind of give you an explanation to him.
Well, before we get into John Howard, I just feel like a really important part of this operation is why they chose the specific bridge, because if if you are the British and you look at a map of France and Normandy, the Pegasus Bridge is well behind enemy lines. But they nonetheless chose the bridge to allow for quick and easy transportation, or to deny quick and easy transportation of Nazi troops and supplies to the beaches, like how we just said with the tanks. And then they knew that if they could cut off the supply line, for the Nazis, they wouldn't be as strong after the initial waves of the soldiers landing on the beaches. So it gave them an upper hand in the long run for the invasions. So that brings us to Major John Howard and the Oxen Bucks, which were an airborne unit for the English armies. And now Major John Howard. Major John Howard was born on December 9th, 1912 in West End, London. He really enjoyed the outdoors because he was in the Boy Scouts and went far into the ranks. He was athletic and he was smart. So there's kind of something for everybody to latch on to about him and kind of personalize him in their lives. After he got a little older, he enlisted into the army, and specifically the King Shropshire Light Infantry Division. And so if you can imagine that, that's kind of like the 101st Airborne Division for the U.S. Whenever he enlisted into the army, going through the training, he really did learn a lot of leadership qualities during his time. And then after he went through basic training, he kind of just fell off and didn't really see much importance for the army and being in it because there was no war going on. So he kind of retired for a little bit and became a cop in Oxford. But after World War II started, he decided to reenlist and was instantly promoted to major and was put in charge of the Oxen Bucks. And that brings us to the Oxen Bucks. The Oxen Bucks is a regiment that stood for the Oxford and Buckinghamshire men, because that is where all the soldiers were from Oxford and Buckinghamshire. They were D Company of the British Airborne Division. They were trained rigorously by Major Howard, and Alex is going to talk about this in a little bit, but they were trained in London while it was being bombed, and he also sleep-deprived his men in order to prepare them for what the war front would put them through on D-Day. And then in 1942, Major John Howard was informed of what his mission would be on D-Day and then began planning for it. And when he was planning it, he planned for every possible occurrence. And now Alec is going to explain what those were and what the roles of the people involved were.
Hello. So before I go into the roles, I'd like to further that point about the training that Major Howard put the Oxen Bucks through. So there were several things he did. He made them go on strenuous runs through England. He made them train during the night to get familiar with the darkness and the near blindness of the night. He made them learn to swim with all their gear on, perform street fighting drills with live ammunition to get experience, force them to play sports to stay active despite being extremely tired. And in addition to all this physical training, it was very important that they knew how to use and were very well versed in the knowledge about Horsa gliders, which I'm going to talk about in a second here, which were very vital to this mission here.
Yeah, Alec, and to that point, the training that he puts them through, I know in the report that my student did a couple of years ago, it talked about how it was so strenuous. They would go on these long marches, and then, like you said, then he would have an athletic competition, and they would have like a contest playing football, soccer. British don't call it football, right? And so they would do these things, and all the while he was teaching them to fight tired is the big thing that he really teaches them to do. And then with the Horsa gliders, and I know you're going to get into those, it's really amazing that they were able to actually land this thing where they landed it. Because as I'm sure you're going to talk about, everything is timing. And so they had to practice all of this stuff. So Alec, let's talk about that.
Yeah, so in this operation, there were four major categories or roles that people had. I'm going to explain all of them more in depth, but it's pilots, sappers, radio men, and infantrymen. So first, I'm going to talk about First, I'm going to talk about the pilots. Basically, it consisted of two main people. It was people who were driving the planes, the Halifax bombers, and people who were within the gliders or the Horsa gliders, also known as the airspeed AS-51 Horsa. So this is probably the coolest part of this mission is the Horsa gliders. They have no engine in them, and they fly behind the main plane. If you have time at home here, look up a picture. It looks just like a regular airplane, but it has no engine in it, and it has no way to stop, actually. So when they were behind the Halifax bomber plane, and they would be like let down. And they had no way to stop. And so when these gliders hit the ground, a majority of the soldiers were actually knocked out, dazed, and many stuff. And Wyatt is actually going to go into that a little bit later when he talks about the longest day. But yeah.
And Matthew, you've seen one of these bombers and actually also seen or gliders. And you've also seen an American glider.
Yeah.
Which one's bigger?
The Horsa glider is actually really bigger. And while we were on the trip, I remember Dr. Long saying that the Horsa glider, since it was that much bigger, it was really effective in the way that it glided and how it landed as well.
Yeah, the American bombers are made, I mean, so cheaply that they just break apart. You're talking like wooden frames and fiber, and they a lot of them, almost all, about 80%, I believe, are destroyed. The British are able to safely land these things. The landings, but the landing gear on them look a lot better too when you get to see them. So, no, that, all really good stuff. And yeah, Alec, I think it is kind of crazy. Like, who would sign up to be in a wooden gliding thing? You're behind a bomber that's going, you know, a couple hundred miles an hour, and they just release a cable, and you got to figure out how to navigate it down, and then it's gravity does the rest, as they say.
Yeah, and more on these planes that are actually carrying the gliders, the Halifax bombers. I did some in preparation for this podcast. You know, I did some research on these bombers, and from what I understand, these planes aren't really that good compared to other bombers within the war. You know, other bombers that were created during this war, and I couldn't really, I tried to find out why exactly they used the Halifax bomber for this operation, and I couldn't really find out. So I've come to the conclusion that maybe it is because of its smaller size to other bombers, and that it was easier to maybe like navigate with the glider of some sort, or maybe it was the only bomber they had for that specific formation. But either way, it's the bomber that they ended up using for this. And after releasing the gliders down, they went and bombed somewhere else. I forget. It was like some like factory or something. Factory? Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was a diversion so that these gliders could land without the German troops being prepared for the attack on Pegasus and Ornbridge. And so sappers, also known as combat engineers, are pretty much what they sound like. You know, in an operation that has to do with a bridge, it's very important you have somebody to check, you know, the stability of the bridge, and also to check if there are any bombs or any landmines or anything around the bridge to, you know, make sure that no British troops are walking on top of these landmines, or if the bridge explodes or something in that sort. Very important that they had those people there to check for any sort of explosives or anything.
Yeah, that's a big fear, is that the Germans might blow the bridges to not let the British break out from the beaches. And so that was one of the big jobs, right? The sappers, they had to go check to see if there were bombs on the bridges. So no, very good.
All right, and now we've got radio men. Pretty obvious. They were people who communicated for this operation, you know, back and forth with home base and between each other and stuff like that, you know, back to London. And when the operation was complete, they radioed Ham and Jam to indicate a successful capture of both bridges. Now, lastly, we got the infantrymen. Again, pretty obvious. It's just the people who had the guns, the gunfire, and were responsible for defending the bridge after they had taken it over originally.
All right. And now I know we have Wyatt. He's going to talk about the operation itself.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that setup, Alec. So going into the execution of the operation, how was the plan actually successful? Well, so these bombers set off late on June 5th, 1944, and the gliders themselves actually landed early on June 6th, 1944, just before the D-Day landings. And the plan was to have the gliders glide in and land around their designated zones in between the Pegasus and Orne River bridges. The plan was men would capture the bridges quietly, minimal gunfire, minimal violence included. And after they captured the bridges, they were ordered to hold the bridges until they were relieved. Now, this actual scenario was presented in a movie, The Longest Day. And now for everyone's favorite segment, Wyatt's World War II movie review. Thank you for that. So I'm going to go into this movie a little bit. Quick preview, it is not historically accurate. So a couple things I noticed. First, in the movie, the soldiers and Major John Howard get out of the gliders as soon as they land, like right when they land. This is actually completely not true. As Alex stated a second ago, a lot of them were like going at high speeds. It was hard to land these gliders. So a lot of them got out like really dazed and confused. This is nowhere in the movie. Just one of the many like inconsistencies in the movie. Second, this actual covert operation is portrayed as a loud firefight. We know in the actual planning of the operation, they planned this to be as to include as minimal gunfire as possible and to be kind of like a quiet taking of the bridge. I believe there's only one casualty the entire time. In the movie, however, it's portrayed as this large firefight. Again, just too much noise and action to actually be accurate to what really happened. And third and finally, the sappers were portrayed completely wrong. They hung from the bottom of the bridge and actually took bombs off the bridge. In reality, there were actually like zero bombs for them to defuse. So those are just three quick reasons. But overall, The Longest Day contains very little historical accuracy. It's a fun depiction of a very monumental war event. But in terms of the accuracy, it's pretty far off.
It has some accurate moments. I don't think there were sappers monkey barring across underneath the bridge looking for bombs. And it dramatizes things, obviously, for Hollywood. So I'm glad you could incorporate your movie into this one.
It's my favorite part. All right. And then back to the gliders, as Alex said, moving on from the movie. As Alex said, these gliders that were used were called the Airspeed AS-51 Horses. Five of six of these actually landed. One of these gliders crashed into the water and the entire company drowned from them. So that was the first kind of major hiccup in the operation. But once the rest of the five out of the six gliders landed, they were divided into two groups of three and a group of two. They then split up and attacked both bridges, carrying out the operation. For the fight itself, it was kind of a cakewalk for Howard's men because, as Matthew had stated before, John Howard had really trained these men hard, especially to fight when they were tired, so they were really well prepared for this. The Nazis, not so much. They were really caught off guard by the surprise invasion and could not successfully counter D Company, leading to little retaliation at the bridge at all. Now, one of these major reasons for this was the fact that Hitler was oversleeping. Now, I know this sounds funny, but it's actually true. During the war, he was the only one that was allowed to give the commands for the panzer tank divisions, obviously a big powerhouse behind the German army. But during this attack, Hitler was actually sleeping and his men were too scared to wake him up, so they let him sleep. This resulted in weak defense against the British and the panzers were late to defend the location. So all because Hitler had to oversleep. Really no retaliation in the invasion of these bridges. Yep. And when the tanks arrived, they were blown up by the Piat. So really good job on Hitler for sleeping. Kind of ruined it all.
Yeah. And part of that, and that actually would be a great idea for a whole other podcast on like specifically on D-Day, is Hitler had taken control away from two different German generals. And he doesn't give either of them permission to do that. And so no counterattack happens and they're actually stifled for a while. And he still thinks the invasion is going to be at Calais all the way until a couple of days later. So that definitely countered a lot of it. So that was a good point, Wyatt.
Yeah. Hitler's not the most adept when it comes to military strategy, even though he seems to put himself in those positions, weirdly enough. But then, as we stated a little while ago, a big part of this operation was actually the timing. The operation of this had to be timed really well to the T, and they did that. The takeoff and landing of the gliders was planned out to the exact second it took for them to land and steer the gliders to hit their marks. and they were also prepared for any possible counter by the Germans. So this attack had been planned in entirety and was really well thought out the entire time, leading to very little dangers and random occurrences throughout it. But then, again, the strategy behind the mission was really well planned out. Strategy was charge the bridge, being stealthy. They're first to take out the machine gun nests because those were probably going to cause the most damage if left unchecked, and then use any means necessary to hold the bridge until they were further relieved. The whole goal was to ensure that the flank to Sword Beach was covered for the men on D-Day. So it was just hold that bridge till you get some help. The actual execution went along really similar to this. It was very swift, very quiet. As I said only one casualty for the Allies, Lieutenant Dan Brotheridge. He was shot in the neck and died immediately. He's actually considered the first casualty of D-Day. But besides that, the operation went extremely smoothly and is seen as a very big success for the Allies. Just to hand it off to Matthew, I think he's going to bring us home here.
Well, before Matthew goes, there are a few people wounded. So casualties are killed, wounded, missing. So remember, there's a whole glider that crashes in the swamp too. So that would be casualties. But yeah, Brethren Ridge is considered the first KIA, first killed on D-Day. The one thing I would like to paint a picture of too is, and this is what always has captured my imagination, is being in these Horsa gliders and you're behind this loud bomber, right? That noise, right? It's just going. And then all of a sudden that tow cable gets released. And the only thing they can then hear is the wind. And what they are doing is they have a stopwatch and they are timing it. And so they know what, and they've practiced this in England on the same coordinates. And so the pilot has a guy with a watch who times it and it goes tick, 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 30 seconds. And then he has to turn right. And he has to hold that right turn for 15 seconds. And then he has to go straight. And then 20 more seconds, he's got to turn again. And then he's got to start to dive down and he's got to release the brakes for it, right? The flaps. And this had to be terrifying. I can't imagine it being something overly fun. Like the guys who are who get dropped out of planes, right? The airborne guys, I mean, they're in a plane the whole time. Then they drop out and they get this quiet and they're just floating down to earth. If you're an infantryman in this glider, you have no bearing on what is going on. You don't know where you are. You don't have the watch. They have the watch. You're just sitting there counting. And that's what they did. Howard had them all count and do the orders as they went through it. And so that way, if he got wounded, if someone else got wounded, they could then all do it. And the last thing you said was they held the bridge. And that was one thing longest they got right, right? The order was hold the bridge until you are relieved. And they get relieved famously by a bagpipe playing British regiment.
Yeah, actually to that point, one of the main really cool things about this operation was it was super individualistic operation. Like they're on their own behind enemy lines. They have their goals set in mind, but once they're dropped in those gliders out those bombers, it's all on them. There's no reinforcements. They got to wait for those. So super just individualistic, take up your own burden and get it done type operation. Very, very cool.
And at one point the Germans try and bomb the bridge. And a bomb actually hits the top of it and bounces off into the canal instead of exploding, which is blind luck, which sometimes pays off. So, Matthew, you're going to bring us home now?
Yeah. But before I start, I do want to talk about the timing that Coach Arvides and Wyatt just talked about real quickly. Book suggestion, Pegasus Bridge by Dr. Stephen Ambrose. He does explain this in about half a chapter, just going over how they timed it and all the little intricate details that went into it. So yeah, that's my book suggestion for this part. Thank you. How did they hold the bridge? Well, they defended against two major Nazi counterattacks that were attempted on them. The first one, as Coach Arvides talked about, a Nazi plane flew over the bridge and dropped a bomb on it, but it struck the back of the draw mechanism. So the only way that I can describe this for you guys at home to understand what it looked like is imagine the old Highway 11 bridge over Lake Pontchartrain, and the little part that is that's brings the bridge down when it's the counterweight to when the bridge goes up. The bomb struck the back of that and then ricocheted into the water and didn't blow up. So that's a little visual if you can imagine that. Dr. Stephen Ambrose also described this in his book. But then the second counterattack that they defended against was two Nazi gunner attack boats. They both shot at the men on the bridge, but one was blown up by a perfectly placed Piat shot, and then the other one fled in order to preserve itself and fight until they were eventually surrendered. But nonetheless, they held the bridge until the troops on Sword Beach arrived for them. And then they also relieved them of their duties on the bridge, but only for a brief amount of time. So the overall importance of taking Pegasus Bridge, it protected the landing of 8,000 paratroopers into Normandy. It led to the invasion and eventual liberation of Paris. However, the exact importance is really unknown. Dr. Ambrose, coincidentally, again, explains this in his book by saying that the importance is unknown because the operation was successful. So if the operation would have failed, then it would have been more evident if this was for a more important reason than just to stop tank advancements. But I guess we'll never know. So what did D Company do after they were relieved from the bridge? Well, quite simply, they were converted into a purely infantry regiment.
All right, I'm going to stop you because this is probably the most insane part of this. So I want you to think about what D Company is, right? This is a specially trained group of commandos that have had more money and training put into them than average soldiers. That's like our 101st Airborne, right? These guys get trained harder. They get the best equipment. They get best of everything. And the British, after D-Day, just throw these guys into the regular army to be used as just average infantry soldiers. It is mind-blowing that they don't use these guys, because the United States, we don't do this, right? Our airborne, our guys in gliders, all that stuff, they're used as specialty units. And they're given big tasks, elite tasks. They stay together. Here, they just get absorbed. And as you're about to say, the results aren't always great.
Right. So since they were converted into an infantry regiment, they were active in both defensive and offensive operations going into the war. But this resulted in many casualties. After they were reassigned to infantry, the company whittled down really quickly from 181 men strong to only 40 men by the time their time in the war was over. So this leads to the question, what happens to the 40 men and the survivors after the war? Well, every year there is a celebration of the capture of Pegasus Bridge that the remaining living members of the Ox and Bucks currently attend. And they also invite any former Nazis that were active in the assault to join them to reminisce about their time in the war. So, I mean, I guess all things do become somewhat good in the end.
Yeah, it is interesting. I don't know how many living members they have anymore. But I know when we were there, obviously we ate at the restaurant and that's where they meet. And they usually meet there, but I don't know how many people were there yet. And the Nazis was a late addition. They started letting Germans come. I think in the 80s was when a lot of the Germans started reappearing over there. So, it's an interesting story. And it's one that I feel like people your age don't know much about, because The Longest Day was made in the 60s. Like, that's not a movie that you guys are like, oh man, look on Netflix. It's The Longest Day. I'm going to watch that. That's not usually one that pops up. However, people in, you know, your parents, your grandparents' generation, they know all about this because of that movie. And so I think that it's interesting that you brought it up, Wyatt, because I think it always is a pretty interesting topic. So are there any last things any of you want to say before we sign off?
I think I'm good.
Alec?
Feel like we covered most of it.
All right. Well, thank you guys. And that was Tigers by the Fire, a podcast at Holy Cross High School about World War II discussions and stories. That was episode 2. Thank you for listening. See you later.